Getting the spirit in the dark. I'm getting the spirit in the dark. People moving. Oh, we're grooving. Just getting the spirit.
From the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, Pacifica Radio, welcome to Poets Cafe. I'm host Lois P. Jones, and our guest is Lynn Thompson. Lynn is the author of three chapbooks and won the 2018 Marsh Hawk Press Poetry Prize for her full-length manuscript, Fretwork. She's also authored Start With a Small Guitar and Beg No Pardon, winner of the Perugia Press Book Award and the Great Lakes Colleges Association's New Writers Award. She is a recipient of an artist's fellowship from the City of Los Angeles, as well as special mention in the 2018 Pushcart Prizes. Thompson's work appears or is forthcoming in Pleiades, Colorado Review, Plowshares, and the New England Review. Lynn serves as reviews and essays editor for the journal Spillway and is chair of the Board of Trustees at Scripps College.
Composition number one. If I say the woman who birthed me betrayed me, you may think that woman badly distilled, needful. But if I say she who betrayed me was herself betrayed, you may think of the woman as gesture, exile, spilled out. Because when we think of exile or the innocent gesture, if there's any such thing as a gesture that's innocent, we should also think intolerable mirror, the mirror never reflecting that it could become obsession or that it might, perhaps, just peel away. If I say peel or blunder or mercy, you might think my vision too fragile, and you're half right. From somewhere, unbidden, the woman waylaid by my birth whistles. Here's a Swain bridge. Cross over. Compose the dark.
Beautiful. Welcome, Lynn. It's such an honor to have you here at Poets Cafe.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
So this is the opening poem from your book, Fretwork, fabulous collection. And I can really feel the way this particular work is not just a way to look at the past, but it's sort of a bridge to her. When you say, here's a swaying bridge, crossover, compose the dark. It feels like the conversation is still going. And there's this kind of a beautiful dark score that goes through the collection. There's permutations from the disturbing, really, to the sublime. Do you sometimes, when you write, do you feel changed by your own work?
Sometimes I do. There's an old saying, I don't know who to attribute it to anymore, but no surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when I think all of us as writers are intentional about what we're doing. And those poems may not be as satisfying in the end because you're not as surprised by them as when you let the poem take you in a particular direction that you hadn't anticipated. And so this poem in particular is one of those.
This is your birth mother. You were adopted.
Correct.
And she appears quite frequently throughout the book.
Correct.
She seems for me to kind of hold the thread of not only a sense of displacement for the child, but also for the person in the world.
Yes.
And how we are displaced.
I'm so glad that came through because I was trying to really talk about that sense of displacement and moving from either one body, in this case the body of my birth mother, to the body of my adopted mother and father, as well as the adopted mother and father's movement from their homeland in the Caribbean to the U.S. So I was, in a general way, trying to talk about that displacement and the effect that it has on themselves as well as all of the people around them.
Right, and there are other poems in the book which focus on immigration. So all of these different voices coming in to talk about that. You met your birth mother.
I did meet my birth mother, mm-hmm, when I was in my 20s, yes.
Yeah. And there are other poems in the book which I wish we could all have time to hit on those. I was so moved by that conversation that you had with her.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, but let's take a look at your father in this next poem.
Emma Gray. Maybe it was reflex. Maybe it was memory and want. Want for the scent of soursop and sugar apples. Memory of the flight of a frigate bird that made us drive every Sunday down Vine Street past Forest Lawn Cemetery to Griffith Park, where Daddy, nutmeg-colored and clad head to toe in his all-whites, came to play cricket and make believe he was home in Bucamont Valley, St. Vincent, West Indies, where he could be the man home would have made of him, although none of that meant one EC dollar to me because, in those days, cricket, with its ball of string and hard cork, wooden stumps and willow-carved blades turned into bats, was an odd British formality. A long ago, when ladies wore pale hose and organdy hats, and I was allowed to wear my Sunday finery, as long as I didn't grass stain my not-for-school skirt, drink tea in royal crown cups, and wolf down cucumber and cream cheese sandwiches those old-world women made for their men to devour during the break in the game, which might last for a leisurely hour or more, before the teams would take up again in a throw of fear because Daddy was the game's best bowler, and with his elbow cocked and a lightning rotation of his arm, he threw googlies, leg breaks, and flippers, always got his man and took the wicket, because Daddy could bring the heat, although he never would have said, "Bring the heat," because his home rule kind of schooling favored the King's English over the colloquial. But it was exactly this heat-bringing and resplendent use of language that made him the kind of man to be reckoned with, and I worked hard to grasp it.
That really paints a great portrait of him. And he didn't appreciate your use of slang.
He did not. He didn't think it was proper English, and he thought it was important to speak proper English. So I remember specifically enlisting a friend to teach me how to use slang because we didn't use slang in the house. So I didn't know.
Lessons in slang.
Lessons in slang. So I didn't really know what I should be saying. So I didn't fit in at home if I used slang, and I didn't fit in school if I didn't use slang.
Yeah,
so
right.
It was a conundrum.
But what an eloquence, you know, incredible poet that you've become.
I attribute that almost exclusively to my dad.
Mm. And did he come to know your work?
He did not. He did not live long enough to see any of my poetry.
Oh, wow.
But he was a closet poet, loved language, was a huge Langston Hughes fan, and really taught me to love reading, to love language and understand how language worked down to the roots of language. You know that if you see this prefix, it means this. And if you see this suffix, it always means that. So he was very particular about it. So I got my love of language and of writing definitely from him.
Mm. And when he came here and interacted, there's this contrast because you can feel that he's come with this reverence for language and the way
Absolutely.
He speaks. And then the person says, "You sure speak strange."
Right, exactly.
For a black man
exactly,
or
because of his accent and because he really did have a resplendent use of language.
Mm.
And when I asked him what shocked him most when he came to America, he said that he expected some prejudice on the part of white folks, but he was shocked to have other black folks, Negroes, as he said in his time, speak to him in the way that they did. He was really put off by that.
Yeah. If you're just tuned in, this is Lois P. Jones, and we're with our wonderful guest, Lynn Thompson, and we're talking about her fabulous book, Fretwork, that's out now. Tell me more about your father.
So he had been a teacher in the islands before he left. He was, I guess, in his early 20s when he left, and came here not knowing if he could teach. And in fact, he never was able to teach elementary school children because he didn't have the certificates, etc.
Okay.
Probably some other reasons as well.
Yeah.
He did teach night school for a long time. Because of the timing, he was able to get work with Lockheed Aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
This was right on the heels of World War II, kind of in the middle towards the end. He was able to get work there and built his way up in that company and became a very respected employee there. So he was something of a self-made man. I remember asking my mother, well, how did Daddy even know, if he didn't go to school, how to become an electronics engineer? And she said, in a very matter-of-fact way, she said, well, he read books. I thought, wow, that's all it takes. Just read
Smart
the book
man.
And you'll figure it out.
Right? Yeah.
So he was a very formal individual. There's a poem in here that talks about, you know, you should go out dressed properly, and he made me promise that I would never go out in the street with curlers in my hair. He thought whenever he'd see a woman like that, he was horrified. He thought it was terrible. So he was a very formal kind of person, always wore a tie and a jacket and read a lot. It was introspective, but a wonderful influence for me and my brothers.
Beautiful. And so your mom, they met?
They met. Actually, they had met in the islands. My mom was 10 years younger than my dad, and he actually taught her in the islands, which was pretty extraordinary. And then when they were here, as immigrants tend to do, they met up again in the States and married in Chicago, where why anybody from the Caribbean would want to live in cold Chicago. But they ended up coming to California.
You have a great poem called Queens.
Ah.
Yeah.
Thank you for picking that, because
sure.
I don't often pick this poem to read. The poem has an epigraph by Gerald Hausman and Ray Griffin. Conjure man spits out piece of glass. Pins, needles, snails, shells, vials, lizards, spiders, flies, cat's teeth, snake skins, and fragments of bone. Queens. Mother and her sister were always proper, 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 and told they were descended from queens, black queens and white queens, Nefertiti and Victoria telling their daughters and theirs, here's your scepter, baby. Stroll that red carpet, but watch out for the rip. Watch out. Behind the door, Obia man got a secret, and it ain't about no queens. He say, remember your auntie, the last queen before the queen that was your mother, the last proper, her legs crossed just above her ankles. She brought your throne. Bought it with her strong black thighs. Bought it from the church parading in the body of a pale Scot minister. Your auntie, she say, lie down on me bed, father. Lie down. Curry this callaloo, pepper pot, all spice all the time. Crown me, sweet Jesus. Answer me prayers. And you that come after, queen's baby. And proper, proper, proper.
Mm-hmm. I love that. You have a very special way, not only with culling the music of the cultural background, but just the music itself. You love music. I can feel that in your work.
Absolutely.
And I want to know, how do you know that when that line is finished? And edits can ruin a line. And what is that sort of subjective sensibility that you have? I know you've been influenced by Nina Simone and Miles Davis. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
I think there was always music in the house. And I've learned that before I came along and before the family had a television, they played music in the evening. My father played the violin. One of my brothers played the piano and maybe some other instruments. And then, of course, you got radio and stereos. And so there was always music in the house. And in some ways, I really think it's just part of me. I have been lucky enough to study with David St. John, who would always drill in us that what the importance of the music of the line,
mm-hmm.
that you should be listening for the music of the line. But I think growing up with, you know, old rock and roll and American musical theater and jazz, it just, you can hear it without even thinking about it anymore. So for me, a poem is never done until I've read it aloud.
Mm-hmm.
And even if there's a line break that's a killer line break that I want, if it's not working musically, I got to do something else.
Mm.
Because the music of the poem, I think, is what propels it and what causes people to listen to it and to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a bit of a map for people because most people have an innate musical sense in some way.
Yeah.
It comes from the drum of the heart. So
I
think that everybody can identify with it, even though sometimes people, as with my first book, my editor said, I get it. You're listening to Miles Davis and I'm listening to Beethoven. So you may not be listening to the same music, but some sort of music is going to purvey, I think, the best of the poems that I read anyway.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully said. Yeah, you feel that music. And it's something that I've thought about a lot in terms of editing, because somebody can come along and edit your poem and you think, oh, they've changed my music.
Correct. Correct. And you have to fight that.
You have
to stand up for your poems. Those are your babies. And you have to fight for them and say, no, I really feel strongly. And if we can't, maybe we have to agree to disagree, but you really have to stand your ground on that, I think.
As I've been reading your work and thinking about the music and your music, how we are instruments.
Correct. Absolutely.
You know, and
absolutely.
Your instrument is you,
yeah.
And mine is me. And that music infuses each poem. But then can we step outside of that music?
Yes.
And make different music?
Exactly. And that's the question.
Yeah.
That's the question. And you do want to mix it up a little bit and
mm-hmm.
thwart expectations.
Sure. How about if we go to this fantastic next poem, which is sort of ekphrastic work, but it takes on a persona as well.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you've asked me to read this poem because it is relying on the artwork of Allison Saar, who allowed me to have this beautiful piece of artwork for the cover of Fretwork. She is an amazing artist. I encourage your listeners to seek her out. Her work is terrific. So this poem was inspired by her sculpture that's called Foundered. Terrible fortune inside my head, Grenadine. And my head lies eternally on its side, its one unbound ear cocked to the wind, always howling, racing away, exposed, expectant. And though my head is made of glass, nothing could be less clear, caked with the dark world's detritus, bone, tissue, links of chain, centuries. And if my head is made of glass, it could not be more clear-cut, if only you would look closely, above my throat, behind both occluded eyes. If you look, you'll see the ship, its masts time-worn, ragged, roots unremembered. Could it be the unnamed slaver that ran aground at spring? And though my ancestors cannot tell me if its provenance, its terrible fortune is false or true, the ship moans, unmoored, for all that's been lost. My head, sideways to history, my free ear, tintinnabulating old miseries of a terror that scored walls of Elmina Castle and all the tortured shrieking inside.
It's really very powerful. I do recommend that our listeners go online and check out Allison Saar's work. Her themes speak to the African diaspora and also Black female identity. And this poem was so interesting to me. First, when I read it, I didn't look at the sculpture. I didn't want to be influenced by it.
Right.
And I thought, wow, this feels like such a voice that's coming from the poet, and it stood absolutely alone from the artwork. And then when I saw the artwork, of course, that magnified what was written. But I was really impressed by the persona that you were able to take on. And how did you enter the work in that way, if you're able to talk about it?
When I first saw the piece, give L.A. Louver a shout out, the gallery that represents Allison. As soon as I saw it, I knew I was going to write about it because it's just so compelling, this glass head. And when you look through the throat of it, you can see this ship. But I also knew, and I think I've said this on other occasions, I love putting public history and private history together. I also knew that the island of Bekwe, where my mother was born in the West Indies, there's a history of a ship, we don't know the name of it, or at least I don't, that ran aground on the island. It's a very small island. But nobody really knows much about that ship, except that the Africans aboard escaped and mixed with the population on the island. So I was kind of thinking about that ship when I saw the tiny ship in Allison's sculpture. And that was the first line that came to me. Could that be the ship that ran aground at spring?
So
the poem kind of bloomed from that.
So there was a story inside the story.
There was a story inside the story.
If you've just tuned in, this is host Lois B. Jones. We're with our guest, Lynn Thompson, and we're talking about her great collection, Fretwork. She's just read this magnificent poem. I really do hope that you do a collection based on her work because, if that ever comes to mind, because I'm so inspired by what you're writing and her work as well.
Well, it does come to mind, and actually I would be honored if she and I have talked from time to time about partnering on some work. This is actually our second partnering, and so maybe there's something in that. Maybe we'll be able to do that one of these days.
I'm going to take us into another poem, which is kind of, as I talked sort of outside of the interview, this a bit of a theme that runs through this reflective voice, this mirroring, and this is called In America's Mirror.
Happy to read it. In America's Mirror, neither bridge nor trapeze, neither absence nor plot, just a hobo with the scent of a scavenger, the romanticized stink of a jackal, as in Darfur, Port-au-Prince, or New York City. Bullet-riddled skull there, neat cough, helix, calcium. But neither tundra nor cobblestone. Neither sharecropper nor fireworks nor pillar. Just a callous brunette gerrymandering the night. Flotsam, labyrinth, unkempt ambition. Ashes on the shallow moon. A little too dangerous, a little thistle. All longitude and moonshine. But neither smoke nor spinet, neither blue stem nor stammer in the white mayhem.
There's a lot in that mirror.
There's a lot in that mirror.
Even just the line, just a hobo with the scent of a scavenger, and just sets a certain tone about how I think many of us feel looking at the country in the mirror right
Absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely. And this poem is quite possibly the oldest poem in this collection. I wrote it a long time ago and didn't have this collection in mind.
Mm-hmm.
But given what the book was talking about and given the way that I'm looking at the country right now, it just seemed to fit.
Yeah.
The question was where I was going to put it in the collection and decided I needed it early on. But yeah, it really does reflect for me what I see when I see America. I think it is a hobo.
It's trying to find its place.
Absolutely.
And boy, it's gerrymandering the night, right?
Gerrymandering the night, exactly.
Was it difficult for you to put this collection together? I know you've talked about it elsewhere.
It was. First, I had the birth poems separate from the immigration poems. I had all sorts of different orders. A shout out to Susan Terrace, one of my editors, for helping me with the order. It was difficult because I couldn't figure out until a local poet, Jerry Garcia, said, Lynn, they need to be mixed up. It's not two separate lives. It's one
Jerry.
Life that has integrated these experiences and melded these experiences for you. So they need to work together. So then I'm trying to figure out, well, which one goes with which one. So it was a challenge, but with the help of many people, I finally hit it.
It's beautiful. Won an award, judged by Jane Hirschfield.
Correct.
We're
no,
very happy.
Very proud about that. Extremely proud about that.
We're closing, coming to the end, and I wonder if you could take us out with a short poem, whatever you want, Memento Mori, or How the Birth Mother Was Found, or your choice.
Yes, I will take us out with How the Birth Mother Was Found. An old friend heard her laughing, thought it was me because she'd heard me laugh before. She turned to the laughing woman. I went to school with your daughter. The woman who birthed me said, I have no daughter.
Wow. Thank you, Lynn.
Thank you so much. I appreciated being here.
This is host Lois P. Jones, and our guest has been Lynn Thompson. Thanks to our producer, Marlena Bond. Look for us on the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.